I'm Richard Dugan, and I thank you very much for joining us here on Tell Me Your Story, a program designed to bring you new paradigms for a new and better world. My guest today is the author and or creator of Humanity Ascending. This is a movie and a DVD that's available, and she is also a part of the vision for our future. Barbara Marks Hubbard is going to be my guest here on the program. We're going to learn about her and her vision for our future as the human family here on this planet. Stay with us.
Walk with me, talk with me, tell me your stories. I'll do my best to understand you.
And that's kind of what it's all about, understanding ourselves, each other, and coexisting together. As I've often said on this program, if the Creator, the good Lord, whatever your point of reference be, had intended for all of us to live on individual planets in a solitary life, I'm certain that there are enough planets out there for 6 billion people on this world anyway, to live all by themselves. But guess what? We're all here. And I kind of get the idea that we're supposed to coexist together. And Barbara, it's good to be coexisting with you here on the program.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
It's an opportunity that we have every Saturday at this time to bring people new ideas, choices, concepts, maybe feelings and emotions that will elicit their creativity within themselves to go out and achieve the things that they want to achieve, whether it be for themselves, which is certainly fine, or for their families, their community, their city, state, nation, or on a global level. And you're thinking globally, and we're going to be talking about that as well as we get into our program. But I want to talk a little bit about the DVD that is available, the movie that came out in 2006 called Humanity Ascending. And my wife and I have seen this when it was shown at the local library here in Santa Barbara. And I was actually blown away. I mean, there are so many movies that have been coming out of late that I would call of a higher thought. Tell me how this came about.
Well, this came about from our lifetime, my lifetime, of searching for the question, what is the meaning of our new power that is good? What are positive images of the future equal to our scientific, spiritual, and social potential? And when I started to look at that, it was triggered by the dropping of the bombs on Japan, because there was so much power there. And I'd been raised as an American, and all power, our power was good. Mm-hmm. And I could see that power could lead to destruction. So my question was, is the power for something really great? And when I started to research that, there is no collective vision of the future equal to our potential.
So you've been researching this for 60 years.
Well,
or 40 almost. Or 50 years.
50, I used to say 40, but it started in the early 60s.
Yeah.
And I think the early 1960s with the Apollo program, we saw Earth from space, we recognized we had an environment, we just found out. We recognized that women woke up, our consciousness expanded, and I think of that as the birth of this next stage of humanity. I call it a universal human and a universal humanity. So I began to look, I called it a crisis of birth. What's really happened recently is the crisis has become obvious. It wasn't so obvious 40 or 50 years ago, but now it's an environment, it's social, it's terrorism, and all those crises cannot be solved by doing more of the same. They're made worse by doing more of the same.
Yeah.
So what I've been researching is innovation, creativity, positive futures, people, teachers, actions, and projects that are now creating a more positive future. And when you start to notice that, you will see we're being born, really, as the next stage of human evolution.
And I have taken a look at certain events and actually made the same comment as you just described, and that is when a particular event, very cataclysmic type of an event in my lifetime has happened, and I see this happening, and I'm going, we have to handle this differently, and then we don't. We handle it the same way as we've handled it from decade to decade and century to century.
What's really interesting is the capacity for us to keep on doing what doesn't work is getting more limited. And just take global warming.
Mm-hmm.
We have, forever, humans have been, they haven't been taking care of the environment. They keep moving west. They keep surviving. They keep reproducing. We didn't even know we had an environment. But nature is feeding back to us now not only just in small ways, but in big ways.
Mm-hmm.
And that feedback from nature is awakening us that we can't go on growing in a finite system with this degree of pollution.
Mm-hmm.
And people all over the world, the Chinese are getting it, the people in India are getting it, the Americans are getting it. So I think it's nature itself that is going to cause the change, not moral stipulations.
I know in a previous program I'd asked one of my guests about Earth, and of course Earth is made reference to in so many different ways, but we'll use the term Mother Earth. And when you refer to Mother Earth, it brings up and conjures up in the mind a person. And so I posed the question to the guest, so let's take all of that and say that Earth is a living, breathing entity. If that's the case, how is this entity feeling? What is going on with this person, shall we say? You know, give it personhood now. I'm really going out on a limb here, but nonetheless, what is happening with this being? Because we are tiny little creatures on it, and we're doing things to it that it doesn't like. And so now I'm thinking, well, maybe it's kind of like our bodies and the antibodies within us that attack the various viruses and bacteria that enter our bodies that don't belong there. I'm not putting us on that level of not belonging, but we're not coexisting. And even if you take global warming out of the equation and say, look, whether you believe or disbelieve in global warming, shouldn't we be taking care of where we live?
No, I'd like to give an even further out possibility
okay.
here to context that question. I think if you look at the billions of years of history of this Earth, 4.5 billion years, and then it finally got, you know, its seas, and then its early life forms, and then its human life form, and now its ecologies and its vast systems, that you will see that literally Earth is giving birth to a form of human life that is just barely capable of co-evolving with nature, just barely capable of understanding environment and being able not only to just preserve it and restore it, but to participate. And if you have understood this recent movement called Bright Green, they're saying nature as we used to know nature does not exist anymore. Nature has toxins in it, in the seas, in the air, in the rainforest, and we have billions and billions of people and more coming in every day. So in order to handle that, we have to learn how nature creates. We call it biomimicry. We have to learn how to build and on the material level with no waste at all.
Mm-hmm.
We have to become ever more intelligent about how nature works. And it's just beginning that we're doing that. It's not that we're returning to some past stage, because first of all, that's impossible. We have 2.2 billion kids on this planet, and many of them are moving into big cities. So either we're going to have a mass destruction and collapse here, or we're going to get intelligent very quickly. And if we do, and if you give a longer range possibility, I think we can restore our environment. I think it's possible to feed, house, and clothe ourselves as long as we limit our population. There is a huge movement for personal growth, health, well-being, and spirituality. It must be hundreds of millions of people are buying those books, going to those workshops, evolving themselves. And then you add social innovations like microcredit loans and new education and conflict resolution, and then go into the big scientific technological breakthroughs like nanotechnology, biotechnology, robotics, space development. You add all that up, you'll see we're facing a crisis where we're either going to destroy ourselves or emerge as a co-evolving, co-creative species.
I know that there are those listening who are very much in agreement with you as far as creating and moving in the very positive and optimistic, hopeful future that we certainly all would like to have. And that, and yet they would also say, well, I don't even want to deal with all of that, the possibility of self-annihilation. And yet, why is it that we need to, I mean, do we need that image to spur us, or should we just stay focused on that hopeful and keep going to the seminars and buying the books and continuing to raise ourselves up?
I think the crisis is very important, and I compare it to a crisis of birth.
Okay.
You just take a baby in the womb. It's heading for a crisis there in the ninth month.
Okay.
It's overpopulating, it's polluting, and it will kill itself and its mother if it stays growing in that way.
Mm-hmm.
The human species, if it stays growing, polluting, and populating in the way that it has in this system, it will destroy itself. It has to feel that crisis, and it's real.
Mm-hmm.
Without that crisis, I don't think we would evolve spiritually, emotionally, environmentally, or scientifically. The crisis is an essential evolutionary driver. This is true in a personal life. If you have a crisis, you'll always see it's either leading to some growth or it can really get you.
Mm-hmm.
The same is true of planet Earth. And if you look at those billions of years of the past, you'll see that crisis precedes transformation. And problems are evolutionary drivers. So I think it's very important to face the crises.
Okay.
But you must be looking to see what the crises is, what is emerging in innovation, creativity, and connectivity. You mentioned the 6 billion people, and you thought that if we all had our single planet, we might be able to get along. Nature is an amazing capacity to cooperate.
Mm-hmm.
You are about 70 trillion cells organized
mm-hmm.
in a living system, talking to another 70 trillion cells, and we didn't do any of that. We didn't organize organisms. We didn't coordinate our planetary ecology. We're certainly not coordinating the universal creativity. So I believe that there is an innate tendency in nature to jump to higher synergy, to more cooperation. And wherever you find people reaching out to cooperate more deeply with each other, the force of nature is with them.
You know, there are so many different schools of thought as to where we've come from, where we are, and where we're going.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, okay, so where do we start looking at that? Because when you start looking at the spiritual aspects of all of this, I mean, because it is said that, you know, we are not human beings living, trying to achieve some spiritual level of awareness. We are spiritual beings having a human experience.
Yes.
So from your perspective, where are we going? The question was raised about a program to be done on this on Tell Me Your Story on the winter solstice. Let's have a topic. Let's have a roundtable discussion. And the topic would be the evolution of humanity. Where are we going? So in the context of spirituality and the soul or spirit of man, where are we going?
Well, in the context of spirituality, I think an evolutionary spirituality is arising, and it is a spirituality that feels within yourself the impulse of creation, the impulse of evolution as your own yearning to express, to create, to be, and to connect. And many people from whatever religion or tradition they come from are feeling more deeply the internalization of the divine. And that divine, for me, is not just an eternal presence. It's the impulse that brought 14 billion years of creativity. It's relentlessly creative. And it usually hits you as frustration.
Mm-hmm.
You're not
mm-hmm.
doing enough. You're not expanding enough. Your life is too limited. If anybody's feeling that right now, that's the impulse of evolution. And if you say yes to it, two things happen. You get more deeply in touch with your own unique essence of that inner reality of the divine. And then you usually get called to some greater action,
mm-hmm.
to some life purpose. You shift from maximum procreation of babies to co-creation, from self-reproduction to self-evolution.
Mm-hmm.
We're living longer lives, having fewer children wherever we have a choice. And what's coming up, this is particularly true in women, is a deep passion to give birth to the authentic self and its work in the world. So evolutionary spirituality is on the rise. And as it matures, you get ever closer to the deeper patterns of creation. And you find that your own life purpose, imagine this is true of you, it's not just a profession all by itself. It's part of the design. We need to know these things. We need to have media that communicates them. You're a vital function in the planetary body, according to my way of seeing it. And anyone who gets a deep calling is called to do something that's part of the larger whole. And because nature is wanting to connect us now, because we can't do this separately, the social networks in health, in education, in science and technology, if you really think about it, there's networking of networks are beginning to happen. Mm-hmm. And if you want to project ahead to December 22nd, 2012, since it's your anniversary mm-hmm. and my birthday, mm-hmm. I would like to say it could be a target for us to have a massive coordination and synchronization, not only of people, but of systems that are working to heal and to restore and to evolve our species.
Yeah.
That we have 5 years here where the system could go into greater collapse. In those same 5 years, through internet and social networking and a vision of ourselves being born as a co-evolving species,
mm-hmm.
I think we should make those 5 years the due date of the conscious awakening of humanity.
And a lot of people would say that there are a lot of people, especially in the business and government, that really need that awakening more than those of us who are thinking about it and trying to do things. But the reality is that we can't do anything about them. All we can do is about us.
Yes, and I think that the them and us is true structurally. But when you look at just take our political scene now. You can see that as people try to run for president, they get narrowed. They have to be oppositional. They have to be competitive.
Yeah.
They're upset with Barack Obama because he won't be critical enough of Hillary.
Mm-hmm.
Now that is absolutely ridiculous. It's his beautiful quality that he's sort of post-partisan. He's trying not to have to attack, and he's attacked for not attacking.
Yeah.
There is a structural breakdown here. These systems are designed for separation, domination, and control. However, the people in them are different often than the systems, but until we have social systems that are more cooperative, there is no alternative. So I don't see us going into a revolution, but an evolution
mm-hmm.
through the connecting of the positive.
You know, in your description of being in crisis and looking at it from the standpoint of, okay, through the process of devolution, the process of evolution comes out the other end, and I think, okay, well, then what was going on before the Big Bang, if we choose to accept that as the beginnings of the universe, then there had to be something before the Big Bang that created and caused that explosion. And I'm not getting into any theological discussion per se, but only as far as what you've described as, okay, we're going through a crisis. And if we look at the opportunities that are there within that crisis that's going to take us to a new level.
Yes.
If we will look at those opportunities mm-hmm. to learn and to grow and to get one with, if you will, be one with nature in particular. I mean, you talk about how nature is giving us about all the clues that nature can give us.
Yes.
I find it fascinating because when you talk about science and technology, I think, well, that just seems so foreign. And no, you can't have science and technology mixed in with nature and spirituality. They can't mix because science and technology is what's gotten us into this mess that we're in. Mm-hmm. I mean, that would be the normal mindset of some.
Well, I see science and technology as a natural outgrowth of our understanding of nature. And that there's a really fascinating theory that they call it the fourth kingdom. We've had the kingdom of the mineral world and the kingdom of the vegetable world and the kingdom of life. And life, human life, created technology. And what is the purpose of technology? Right here on Earth, we can see it has expanded our intelligence, expanded our lifespan, expanded our resources. But it's hit a limit if it continues to grow in a closed system with the impulse to consume and defend the way it is used. It's misused. But if you change the goalpost just a little bit of science and technology, and you see that its purpose is restoring the earth, freeing us from hunger, poverty, and disease, and beginning the vast exploration of the solar system, wherein I think the extension of human life, the extension of human intelligence with supercomputers, is really not necessarily meant for the biosphere. And I have many friends who are in the new space movement, and they are wanting to actually create habitats in space to terraform Mars. Do you know that in 30 or 50 years, the human species could be not only an Earth-based species, but a solar system species? And we would have no resource shortage, no space shortage, no shortage whatsoever. So what's needed with science and technology, I think, is new leadership to guide it towards the actual evolution of our species, towards what I think of as a co-creative, co-evolving, universal humanity.
If you've just joined us, my guest is Barbara Marx Hubbard, and we're talking about our future, not just hers and mine, but our future collectively as a city, a state, a nation, a world, to, again, evolve and raise ourselves up from where we are today. I remember as a child growing up watching cartoons and watching the Jetsons and saying, boy, in the 21st century, we're going to be flying around in cars. I mean, that was what I thought as a child, reading, seeing these things, thinking, oh, this is going to be so cool. And there was never a date put on the cartoon, but that's where the mind went. And now here I am in the 21st century, and not even close. Not even close. But there have been some incredible processes, especially evolutionary processes in technology, to say the very least. I've been through personal growth and development programs. I've been through workshops and seminars. I've been through counseling, done interviews with people on just about every subject you can think of. Death and dying and sex and taxes and drugs and government and the environment and on and on and on. And I find myself here today in Santa Barbara using that technology that you're talking about. But at the same time, when I leave here, I go up the hill, up Highway 154, that you are very familiar with, I'm sure. I live up at the summit.
Mm-hmm.
And my wife and I have a great little place that we live in, and we have chickens. Now, you talk about being in harmony with nature. If I wasn't here, I would be there. Not just because that's where I live, but because I love being up there and working with the with the ground and with the animals. I didn't think it would be this much fun to be amongst two dogs and four cats and 28 chickens and on and on and on, and utilizing the scrap materials that are on the property to create a bigger and better and more secure chicken run and coop for them so that we can have more eggs that we actually have available to people. I never thought that. When I was 18, took an aptitude test, and that's what said, oh, you should be a farmer. And I'm thinking, you got to be kidding. Me, a farmer? I don't think so. And I went into radio, which I guess was also appropriate. You, on the other hand, you came at it from a different perspective as far as coming to this place where we are today. Can you give us a little more of your background? I mean, you've described how you came to the vision and how you have worked and created various you've created, I don't know how many different foundations and groups and organizations over the years to help people to move forward and raise themselves up, both physically, mentally, emotionally, and spiritually.
Mm-hmm.
But tell us a little bit about Barbara Marx Hubbard and what makes her tick.
Well, you know, you talk about you as a farmer. I think my version of that was being a mother. And I had five children. I got married in 1951. And I married an artist. I met him in Paris. And I asked him my favorite question, what do you think is the meaning of our new power that's good? And what's your purpose? And he said, I'm an artist. And I'm seeking a new image of humans commensurate with our power to shape the future. And I immediately thought, I'm going to marry you. I really did mm-hmm. marry him. And he told me that if you look from Michelangelo's sculpture of David, and you go through the Renaissance art, and then you go through Monet, Manet, Pizarro, Picasso, Jackson Pollock, and you end up, in those days, it was 1948, 49, just the human image had fractured. We had had two world wars. The greatest, most sophisticated cultures on Earth had failed. And we were at the threshold of self-destruction already.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, of course, it's increased. So we got married on the quest for a new story. And I notice your program is about storytelling. Mm-hmm. When a culture loses a story that it believes in, and when it loses an image of its own potential and future, then it begins to crumble. And he told me at that time, we lost our story, and our story was inevitable progress through technology and so liberal democracy. We lost our story that fundamentalist literal interpretations of the Bible could make for peace.
Mm-hmm.
We lost our story that we were all divinely inspired.
Yeah.
When you saw the terrible things that we did to each other. And he said, we need a new story and a new self-image. And we got married on that quest. And then, of course, I had lots of babies. And with every baby, the quest deepened. Because if I didn't know the meaning of my own life and the life of our own species, how could I really give it to my children? So I was a wonderful mother, 24 hours a day, but I was also a seeker.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved my children like you love those chickens.
Mm-hmm.
And you're doing this radio show.
Mm-hmm.
If you were only doing the chickens, it might not bring forth your full potential. What I found as a woman and a mother, and particularly having married with that question, is that unused creative potential in me started to show up around the fourth or fifth child, and I got depressed. And that depression was interpreted by the Freudians at that time as there's something neurotic in me.
Hmm.
And then I met a man called Jonas Salk, Dr. Salk, and I was telling him all the things wrong with me. That I have this desire for the future, that I'm innately attracted, that I feel the need for greater connectivity. And he said, Barbara, that's not what's wrong about you. That's what's right about you.
Mm.
You are an evolutionary soul, and I will introduce you to a few others I found in 25 years. In other words, in those days, in the early 60s, the idea of being an evolutionary soul, of having this sense of something emerging, was really not out there. And when I met the others, and I started to read Teilhard de Chardin, and I read Sri Aurobindo, who explained to me the divine force as a force of evolution.
Mm-hmm.
Both of them did. I had what it really amounts to a conversion experience, as I realized that this passionate desire in me for more life, for more expression, for more connectivity, was not neurotic. It was the universe showing up as me and you and each other. And I jumped
mm-hmm.
from a frustrated housewife into a very early evolutionary soul.
Yeah. My broadcast career, the first 15 years, I was in the religious radio. And when you said that about your awakening, the words just echoing in my head, you were born again.
I was.
But everybody is. And what's interesting is it doesn't happen just once. It can happen again and again throughout your life because you reach those milestones.
You reach those milestones. So I was frustrated.
Mm-hmm.
I was desirous of growing, of connecting. I met one or two people. I met Dr. Abraham Maslow. I called him up and invited him for lunch because I read Toward a Psychology of Being. And I realized that I wasn't neurotic. I hadn't found my vocation.
Yeah. That's what the problem is, in one sense, for a lot of us.
He said that every self-actualizing person had one thing in common, chosen work they found intrinsically self-rewarding that served others. Now, I was a really good mother and loved my children, but my true vocation was not motherhood. I didn't know that. There was no clue in the 50s that I could have had a deeper vocation. So with Maslow, he gave me a list of 300 names. He called it the Good Souls Network, that later became the Human Potential Movement. And I wrote to everybody.
Mm.
I wrote a center letter, and I said, what do you think is the next step forward for the future? I think we're being born. I had this mm-hmm. intuition. And I started to meet people, and I started to network and connect with others who are seeking where the human race is going.
Yeah.
And through that, I became what you see now. And I realized one of my most important tasks is to send out the word to as many people as possible so that when they feel that inside themselves, that depression or that frustration or that desire to connect, that is the universal process of creation, the divine force in them. And they have to follow the compass of joy. They have to follow the attraction. And they have to meet others, go wherever you're attracted, meet those you're attracted until you find the life purpose that connects you to the impulse of creation. I call that true vocation.
Well, I know that when my wife and I lived in Phoenix, we had a group of people that we were connecting with. And, of course, we have been here for about a year and a half, and we have been searching and searching and searching and searching and searching. And then we started the radio program, and lo and behold, they're coming out of the woodwork.
Yes.
And it is one of our dreams, of course, to have, and it's interesting, not to have a community, to have community.
Yes.
As a verb.
Yes, yes. Well, you can count me in as one of your community.
Welcome to the neighborhood.
Thank you. It's a wonderful neighborhood. And I'm part of that community. So many people are all around the world.
Yeah.
But it's great to have them also right where you live.
Absolutely, because we all need to connect with like-minded, as my wife and I refer to it, you know, like-minded people. Sometimes we do get down, no matter
of course.
Much we're focused on these issues and these points.
Mm-hmm.
You know, life happens. I mean, I work at a full-time job, and then I have two or three other part-time jobs, and I've got to earn the money to pay the rent and buy the groceries.
Yes.
I mean, the realities of this dimension of human existence, they always want to knock us down. It's just like, I guess the best description is that I heard in a program that I went through. You have lobsters in a pot, and they put them all in the pot in the water, and then they turn the heat up. And as the heat gets hotter and hotter and hotter, the ones on the bottom are crawling over the ones on the top to get to the edge, and as they just about ready to pull themselves out, one reaches behind, who's doing the same thing, and pulls them back into the water.
Yes, 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 yes.
And the negative aspects of this life do that. So we need that community to help to bolster us. Yes, I know you're going through that, and it's okay.
Yes, this is so important, and we need community, cooperation, co-creation. And I feel that the human species is really a transitional species.
Interesting.
that we're just, many of us, at the very earliest stages of becoming a co-creative species. But our nervous systems, our survival needs, our materialistic basis, in the last 7,000 years, we've had what they call a pyramid-like structure. And there's been the dominator, and then everybody is working within that structure.
Mm-hmm.
What's happened recently is that the pyramid structure of organization, whether it be the nation state, the organized religion, the academic institutions, structured for control and separation and scarcity.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And the whole money system is reaching a limit because the planet is about to break down.
Yeah.
And our social systems are breaking down. The new systems, there's one wonderful writer called Jean-François Nubel, N-O-U-B-E-L, that I've just come across, who's written brilliantly on global collective intelligence, the invisible revolution.
Oh, wow.
And this, you can look it up, Nubel, N-O-U-B-E-L. Global collective intelligence moves way beyond the pyramid structure of dominance, control, and scarcity into the cyberspace that's able to connect people by interior meaning with each other. And he sees a whole new monetary system coming in and a whole new level of connecting, just like we're doing right now.
Yeah.
And it, as long as you're in an environment of dominance, control, and scarcity, you can't do it.
Yeah.
So the shift here, we happen to be caught in that transition.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that, let's say, the whole 21st century, but certainly the next 5 to 10 years, is the shift when this new social species that is connected via interior meaning and creativity, just like we're doing here,
mm-hmm.
where your genius is being drawn forth by the others, where you enter a more synergistic convergence so that we have common goals, we match needs with resources, and we're able to jump into a higher order. Nowhere on earth does that yet fully exist. Maybe in the early tribal cultures, in the original peoples, we lived closer to nature. This was an original collective system.
Yeah.
Then when civilization came in, we moved into a pyramid type structure that built, and it was the word, the written word, and the pyramids and the great Roman Empire, and recently the enormity of our science and technology, our Apollo program, they were all done out of a genius for the pyramid structure, but the complexity on Earth is too great, and the problems are too great for that structure to work anymore, and they're breaking down.
Yeah.
So people like you and me, I don't know anybody whose material life and organizational structure matches the higher aims. They might be earning money in the old system,
yeah,
but to actually be truly succeeding in the new, not only just personally, but as a community or as co-creative organization, it's embryonic.
And I find it fascinating you bring that up, because that is probably the struggle that I, and I'm not alone, I'm sure, have, as far as striving for these higher things, knowing that I have to also do this other thing down on a lower level, as we'll use that terminology, and saying, I know there's another way to exist. There's another way to function, and to have a community, and to have community is that other way, where there's no one person who's in charge. We collectively say, okay, and just because I've mentioned this before, all right, group, community, we'll provide the eggs. Okay? And then someone else comes in, okay, we'll provide the fruits.
There you go.
And someone else comes, construction, and so we've even discussed the possibilities of trying to find a piece of land and a little log cabin kit and just building it there and so forth. And I say, you know what? If we found a piece of property with a hill, I would build into the hill. That's where the home would, not a cave quite, but you know, you build in and you use the natural heating and cooling of the earth to eliminate the necessity for having air conditioning and heating, although fireplace is always nice and windows are always nice too. But it's like, I know there's another way that we've not, I want to say that we've never tried before. And in one sense, as you're saying, that we really haven't.
So we're reinventing civilization.
Yeah.
So that is a nice way to put it. Our crisis is the birth.
Yeah.
Of a new human, a new humanity, and a new civilization.
I have to say, excitement, it just wells up inside.
And we're pioneers.
Yeah.
And I often think of the pioneers on the physical plane that came over to this world from the old world. And they went across this country in their covered wagons with the grandmas and the kids and the no doctors and no grants and no money and not understanding how this nature worked at this level.
Yeah.
And they did it. And when I fly across this country, I think, what that took.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
Now, at the level of spiritual social pioneering, that's where it's really happening. And I think at the social level is where the genius has to come in now. We've had a lot of great spiritual teachers, and many of us are becoming awakened from within to a divine potential, I would say. But I don't know anyone where the social system, including the monetary system, and the creative aspects of people actually works to the fullest of our capacity. So let's say we're real pioneers.
Okay.
And it's not easy. But when I talk to you, I can see an emerging human. I can see a member of the transitional species aiming at something else. And I'm not an optimist. I'm a potentialist.
Ah, I like that.
It's a nice distinction.
It is.
An optimist thinks it will inevitably get better. A pessimist thinks it will inevitably get worse. A potentialist sees what's possible, what's innovative, what's creative, even if it's very small, and tries to create a map of connectivity of that which is creative.
But we also have to celebrate even those small
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
No matter how small, if they're going in the right direction. Now, this is another spiritual thought. If the direction of evolution is, as Teilhard de Chardin put it, higher consciousness, greater freedom through more complex order. And you can look at it from atom to molecule to cell to humans all the way on up. If that tendency towards greater complexity is leading in millions of us toward more connectivity, more empathy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're feeling with the suffering of people all over the world.
Oh, yeah.
That's a new thing. More creativity wanting to be unleashed, that this is the direction of evolution. And we talked about what came before the Big Bang. This comes from Aurobindo, a great Indian sage, as well as Teilhard. But he saw two aspects of the divine. One is pure eternal awareness. That would be God in the more eternal form. Mm-hmm. And the other is consciousness force that has directionality, that has purpose. And it manifests as atoms, molecules, cells. They're all intelligent, but they don't know they're intelligent. And then you get to humans and we begin to be mental and we're able to understand. And just now, I think, through evolutionary spirituality and evolutionary understanding, we're catching a hold of our whole birth narrative. That it took 14 billion years to get us sitting here at this radio station talking.
Yeah.
With these eyes and these ears and these thumbs and this technology. Let's say it's all meaningful.
Mm-hmm.
And let's say it's all here to produce a species capable of co-evolving with nature and co-creating with spirit, co-creating with the divine pattern. Maybe we're being born, you know, in the image of the divine. Maybe the transition from the creature human to the co-creative human is the transition that is in the deep design of nature and spirit to create co-creators.
I sit here in awe of what you are saying because many years ago when I was doing interviews in Phoenix, because I love doing this so much.
I can see you're very good at it too.
Thank you. I used the description, for me, doing an interview is like Christmas morning and opening a package. And I don't know what I'm going to get. But I know that there are going to be bits and pieces or maybe big old chunks of whatever they have to share that I might be able to incorporate into my life. And I'm sitting here with you going, this is a huge box. And it just keeps coming and coming.
Lots of goodies in here.
Oh, it's fabulous. I mean, this just, it excites me because I have known that there are people out there. My wife and I both know that there are people and groups of people, small ones and large ones, that are striving towards that same goal from different angles, different points on that circle. And again, we are now in the process of connecting with them. We would have gatherings in our home of people. And we at one point, all of our tables were low to the floor. And we had pillows all over the place. And I loved that. It was so cool. It didn't make it real comfortable, say, when parents and family would come over because they're used to, well, you need chairs. Where are your chairs? But actually, they actually liked the idea that we were sitting on the floor. And we would have a fire pit out in the backyard and on, all of those accoutrements. And it was such an incredible thing. And we would create my dearest friend, who I call my big brother, who passed away in our home. He and I built for my wife and with her a greenhouse and little patio areas. I mean, we were creating and we were our own little triad community. And we want to impart that it's possible and B, that it will happen again. And the things that we will be able to create will just absolutely be astounding.
You're a potentialist. You see, and if you look at the amazing potential from subatomic particles to atoms, molecules, cells, however that happened, whether you believe a God did it, whether you believe nobody did it, was by physical laws and random selection, or if it is a intrinsically intelligent universe programmed towards ever more intelligent life, which is what I believe, then you find yourself part of a zeitgeist, part of a process greater than your will just to help make it happen.
What was that term again?
Zeitgeist.
Zeitgeist,
sort of the direction and the current. And I think of my image for this is if you think of a spiral, so the formation of universe, earth, life, animal life, human life, and now our turn on the spiral is we're going around another quantum jump from pre-life to life, from animal to human, from human to, I put, universal human.
Yeah.
That's what's in my DVD, our story. That's what you can get on evolvingnow.com.
That's evolvingnow.com.
Yeah.
Now, can they get there through your other website, because that's the one I have linked to mine.
BarbaraMarksHubbard.com.
And they can get to?
To there, yes, they
great.
Can. But we have a new website where we're actually inviting people to participate who feel this way, and mm-hmm. I think we should work together, you and I.
I think that would be fabulous.
I think you have the same motivation I do, and it is to communicate and to commune with the people you're communicating with.
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
I think this is very, very important.
This is probably one of the most astounding interviews that I have been a part of. When we first started these many years ago, when I first started doing them, even before I met my wife, I took the position, the interviews are going to go, they would ask me, you know, beforehand, can you send me some questions? No. I says, well, why not? I says, I have no clue what I'm going to ask. The interviews go where they go. And we come to Santa Barbara and the same attitude begins. But then I said, well, but I don't want the show to go in this way. I thought, wait a minute, those are diametrically opposed concepts, because you can't, on the one hand, control the show overall and then let each interview go where it wants to go. So I had to give it up. I said, show's going to go wherever it's going to go. I have no control. I'm just going to go along. I'm going to go along for the ride and the excitement and the fun and all of that. And it just, I can't, there are times when, and there are times when I don't want to verbalize the I can't believe this is happening kind of thing, because I'm here and obviously it's happening.
You know what I call this? Real time.
Yeah.
I have moved into real time. Just take this interview. The real time part for me is that I've met another pioneering evolutionary soul. And by us communicating and communing mm-hmm. here, something new has happened in the world.
Yeah.
Because out of the relationship, I can see all kinds of things growing. And this is contributing to the evolution of ourselves, our community, and our world. Yeah. And I can see that you are a very important person in the transition of our species, because you've got the passion. See, without the passion, you can't create these days.
Yeah.
It has to be focused passion, where you give yourself beyond what you know how it's going to turn out.
Yeah.
That's the way I've been for years.
Well, there are two elements that we have to let go of. Number one is the how mm-hmm. and the what.
Yes.
In that you say universal human. Well, we don't know what that's going to look like, and we really don't know consciously how we're going to get to that new species, if you will. All we know is We're going.
And also, I believe, I can just hear it in your voice, coded in you and me and others like us, is a deep intuitive knowing already.
Yeah.
But there isn't a lot of social verification for it. So people tend to submerge it, not think it's real. But if they hear your voice, my voice, and all the others who are part of this, they will be reinforced in the code. And I call it an evolutionary code. And I it's like you have a genetic code that is programmed to create a specific mm-hmm. you. The evolutionary code is that in you which isn't yet fully expressed, mm-hmm. but is your divine potential.
Yeah.
And it gets triggered by books, teachers, people, and most deeply by resonant communication.
Mm-hmm. It is a most remarkable, an astounding, it brings to the mind that one phrase that we hear more and more these days, I'm having trouble wrapping my brain around it. And in one sense, it's almost like, don't bother, because you can't. You just have to embrace it with your being, as it were.
Let the brain fumble
through and try to figure it out, but don't worry if it doesn't. I had an experience today, the day of our interview here, with a gal at my full-time job, and she buys eggs from us. And 2 days ago, I thought, you know, I should put a dozen eggs in my lunch bag, just because she hasn't ordered all week, and normally every week she does. She comes to me today, says, do you have eggs with you? And I said, you're not going to believe this. And I told her, you should follow that impulse next time, you know, you and your impulses, follow them next time. And I told her, well, I'll bring you a dozen, you know, next week. And that, in and of itself, that experience that we all have, that prompt, okay, you should turn left here. Don't turn right. And I've had this, I used to bicycle everywhere, and I'll tell you off air the story of all this. But I would bicycle everywhere, and I would go to and from work, and it was straight shot. I didn't have to deviate much because it was pretty much a straight line. But there were times when turn left down this road. Don't go that. And I would actually go three blocks down the way I was not being prompted, and it would get stronger. And I literally would turn around and have to go back the three blocks and make that turn. I didn't know why. I didn't know what it was that I was either avoiding or going to.
Mm-hmm.
All I knew was, this is the way, and I couldn't shake it. And there were times when I would ignore it completely, and then I would feel guilty when I would get to my destination, going, maybe I should have gone that other way. I don't know what I've changed that I didn't want to start creating. And that's something else, that whole conscious, you follow those impulses. You don't know whether you're avoiding an accident or avoiding, or you're, it's taking you in a direction where you're going to meet up with. Okay. We don't know. But when we start following those impulses, isn't that part of this whole?
Absolutely. I mean, the mental, critical, analytical intellect has brought us a long distance, but it cannot understand the dynamics of whole systems shift. It can't understand when something's emergent that hasn't yet manifested, and it comes through intuition, passion to create, resonance, attraction.
Yeah.
And Jean-François gave me this word. I said, how do you work through this complexity? He said, blissipline. And the discipline of bliss, which is following those intuitive attractions or signals or cues from nature that you don't ordinarily pay attention to.
My wife uses that phrase all the time as far as bliss. You know, I'm in my bliss. And then if she has a situation on the job or on the road or in a store or something like that, she'll come to me with a little frustration but also some humor, saying, they're harshing my buzz or my bliss, you know. And that can happen. That can happen, and we need to find those anchors, those cues, whether you carry a list in your pocket and say, okay, well, when I'm in my bliss, I'm thinking of da 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 da. So you bring out the list and you say, okay, let me think about da da da.
You need it very quick. And I have a recent way of doing it. I call it the still center of the turning spiral. And if you think of the evolutionary spiral for the billions of years, and you see the core of the spiral being the divine impulse of creation, I think it's coming through the center of every one of us. And I see it as a wheel in our turn in the spiral. And there's all these different functions like health, education, communication. If you're called from within toward that higher order, that higher bliss, there's a still center inside you that is not just you alone or even you and God alone, but you and the process of creation at rest, so that you're being guided more by that impulse that is actually guiding universal evolution.
Yeah.
And the minute I put myself at the still center, I rest assured, and I know that I can't figure it all out and make it all work at the existing material level. I can do some of it, but I can follow my attraction, and I can do the best I can. And my particular vocation is to communicate evolutionary potential.
Yeah.
Your vocation, you see, that's why you're a transitional species. It's total passion and creativity for what you have to give.
I am just, as I said, I've done so many interviews as I stumble through this. And I look at the clock, okay, zero, and here we go. And the next thing I do, I look up at the clock, and we're almost out of time in the program.
Yes.
I mean, and I love that. And then there are times when we're doing the program, and it is literally, we're going through it and through it and through it, and it's like it just keeps going and going and going and going, and we're still within the time frame, but it feels like much longer time, and my wife refers to that as bending time.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that. When I'm with the chickens, and I'm building and doing and cleaning and whatever it is that needs to be done, I feel the same way. There's never enough daylight. There's never enough time to just spend and just really... Because it's almost like I want them to live in a 5-star chicken coop, you know. However, I haven't quite, I don't even think I've reached the one star yet, but I'm working on it. I'm working
on it.
That's
so sweet, Richard, really.
But it's even with these kinds of programs and bringing this information to people, which is what this program is designed to do, is to get this information out. If you've heard it before, terrific. Then it'll continue to resonate with you. If you've never heard it before, wonderful, first time. I learned something interesting in my religious broadcasting career. They used to talk about the word never returns void. So I realized that once you've heard it, no matter how you feel about it, you can't unhear it. And so one day, you'll reach a certain point in your own personal evolution as the listener and going, you know, I heard some time ago about... And then it starts you moving in a little different direction than you may have thought you'd ever go.
And if that evolutionary code inside you gets turned on, you start being attracted to certain things that maybe you weren't attracted to before. You sense more creativity in yourself, and you reach out to somebody or something. You go somewhere and always follow that, and then deepen the relationship with that which attracts you.
Yeah, that's what we need to do. And what we'll do is next week we'll deepen that attraction in this program even further with our next guest. I look forward to having you back again, because obviously there's never enough time to really get it all out there, because there's so much. There are so many different, again, points on the circle that we're referring to as this evolution of humanity, heading towards the universal human, if you will. We'll coin the term.
I like that. It's clean. It doesn't have any old connotations.
Exactly. Well, I want to thank you again. I want to remind our listeners that you can go to, and it's evolvingnow.com.
Yes.
And you can go there, and you can get further information. You can participate, as you've mentioned.
Yes. Join the community and communion of evolutionary souls.
Absolutely. And you can also go to my website, richarddugan.com, and you can hear this interview again. It'll be available right after the program is over, and you will be able to participate in that respect. And I certainly hope you'll email me, too. It's richard@richarddugan.com. That's richard@richarddugan.com. Thanks for joining us. Love to Lal.